From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Georgia lawmakers could bring back the electric car credit.
Welcome to the electric car of the future.
I'm an electric car. I can't go very fast or very far.
Electric vehicle sales took a major hit when the state backed out of a $5,000 tax credit. Did you decide to stay gas-powered as a result? The Breakroom Gang weighs in later this hour. But first, yesterday we talked about how to keep track of guns emanating from Georgia.
Then the only way you can enforce that is to have registration of firearms, and we are not for registration of firearms. If you don't have registration of firearms, how do you know that I sold it to somebody? Gun control doesn't work.
That's Jerry Henry. He's the executive director of Georgia Carry. Here are your first thoughts. Al Effendi tweets, "The argument that anyone really wants to get a gun will get it is a lethal, logical fallacy." We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. On social media, national news, and local shows like this one, you've probably seen or heard about the latest internet craze, eating laundry detergent pods.
If you haven't heard of the Tide Pod Challenge, it's pretty simple. Teens video themselves eating laundry detergent, then post it online. Yeah, welcome to 2018.
The Tide Pod Challenge is definitely weird, but more importantly, it is actually very, very dangerous. The Georgia Center for Poison Control says it's confirmed at least one case of a pod making a teen very sick. Dozens have been hospitalized across the country for doing this. Yes, the phenomenon of kids doing dumb things significantly predates the phenomenon of the internet, but are we seeing something new here, a new kind of dumb danger? Joining me to talk about this whole Tide Pod Challenge thing, where it came from, what it says about the internet and its users, it's Jay Hathaway, senior writer at The Daily Dot. Jay, when you got into journalism, do you think you'd ever be on the Tide Pod beat?
I did not. I didn't see this one coming, which is funny because Tide Pods have been around for several years and people
Indeed.
Have been eating them for several years. So,
oh, Lordy. Well, we'll talk about where it's all coming from. Also with us to subject this trend to the scientific scrutiny that it so deserves is Catherine O'Neill, assistant research scientist at the University of Georgia's College of Family and Consumer Sciences. Hi, Catherine.
Hey, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, Jay, as far as you have been able to trace the origins of this trend, where is it coming from?
Well, so Tide Pods were first launched back in 2012, and people were accidentally eating them way back then. That kind of turned into a joke. The Onion had a piece in 2015 called "So Help Me God, I'm Going to Eat One of Those Multicolored Detergent Pods." And they did another one mid-2017. So this has kind of been, you know, professional humorists have been joking about this for as long as Tide Pods have been around.
How do you reckon one accidentally eats Tide Pod? Does it sort of look like candy?
Oh, it absolutely looks like candy. And, you know, consumer advocates have pointed this out for a long time. Tide had to change the packaging, like, just months after Tide Pods came out so that you couldn't see through the box to the little candy-looking detergent pods inside, because kids were already mistaking them. Young kids were already mistaking them for candy.
Okay.
So, So
the question, well, one question here is, does Tide have any corporate responsibility for all of this? They have put out a PSA featuring who? Of course, Rob Gronkowski, Gronk of the New England Patriots. Let's listen.
No, 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 no. What the heck is going on, people? Use Tide Pods for washing, not eating. Do not eat.
Jay, how do you reckon Tide has responded to all of this?
So the CEO of Procter & Gamble, the Tide parent company, wrote a blog post. It basically blamed teens and parents for eating Tide Pods. He said, you know, we've tried everything. We've taken the Tide Pod Challenge videos down from YouTube. We did this PSA with Gronk. And even with the most stringent standards and protocols, labels and warnings, you know, they're still eating them. But, you know, the thing that he left out is they still look like candy.
Catherine O'Neill with the University of Georgia's College of Family and Consumer Sciences. As a scientist of human behavior, what interests you about this phenomenon?
Well, I think it's clearly just an overall interesting phenomenon, just because it is one that makes you almost scratch your head and wonder what's really going on here. But, you know, I think we couch this, like, thinking through it from a cognitive development standpoint, and we think about, we know that the frontal lobe of the brain isn't yet developed for adolescence, and we know that that's important because the frontal lobe is responsible for these executive functions that allow them to plan and have impulse control. And so this allows them to make good judgments, you know, think like, what is right and wrong and what's harmful and helpful? And while that seems really intuitive, and it's something that adolescents really can do on many occasions, but occasionally they have those lapses where they don't use those skills, or they really can't because they don't have that rational part of their brain fully developed yet. And so instead they use the amygdala, which is like the emotional part of their brain. And so it's really all about like what's novel, that is what's new, and what's an increased risk. Like that's what's fun. That's what excites them. So I think that's where it fits into, you know, like the Tide Pod Challenge. You know, if you think back to what you were just saying about you know, like what can Tide do, what do they need to do? I don't think for adolescents, it doesn't hinge on, oh, I just want to eat this because it looks like candy. I think it goes back to that, the lack of impulse control, and I'm doing it because of the larger Tide Pod Challenge, not necessarily because it looks like candy.
Yeah. So important to understand that kids don't just do dumb things out of lack of experience. It's in their hardwiring. Jay, do you think that the internet has uniquely enabled this problem? Is this something that could have happened prior to the internet age?
I mean, I suppose it could have, but the internet has definitely accelerated it. You know, it became a joke because of social media, and you know, the joke being, hey, these laundry detergent pods look like candy, but they're actually poisonous. And, you know, kids have like a pretty well-developed sense of irony, and they picked up on that pretty quickly. And, you know, because of that joke, Tide Pods became popular. And then it sort of spun into this big media thing about the Tide Pod Challenge. So, you know, I think without the internet, I don't think it would have happened nearly as fast.
Catherine, same question to you.
Yeah, well, I think that's the media component actually plays into the second part of adolescent development that's important here, which is like the social development. And we know that adolescence is a time where they really shift from thinking about, you know, parents and their family as the center of their interactions versus they're all about their peers and what do their peers think of them. And I think social media really gives them the platform to get immediate feedback in a lot of sense from their peers. You know, they post this Tide Pod Challenge, they get likes, they get shares, they get comments. And so I think that need for, you know, acceptance from peers is much easier to get through social media in the sense of these types of challenges. So, you know, could it exist without social media? Sure, I think it could. Like, would it have the ammunition? Would it have the amplification that it has? Likely not.
We're talking about the Tide Pod Challenge and other potentially dangerous internet memes and the risky behaviors that they can lead to. Poison control officials in Georgia say they've dealt with at least one case of a kid eating a Tide Pod and getting sick as a result. Lots and lots of other kids across the country have gotten very seriously sick eating these little laundry detergent pods that look like candy and about which people are daring them to eat. Talking to Catherine O'Neill, assistant research scientist at UGA's College of Family and Consumer Sciences. Also with us, Jay Hathaway, senior writer at The Daily Dot. We were talking some folks on the street about what they make of this phenomenon. Here is Arthur from Decatur, Georgia.
I haven't personally eaten any Tide Pods, so I haven't faced the wrath of it, so it's kind of funny, yeah, but don't eat Tide Pods. That's not funny.
No, it's not funny. And here for me is the biggest question of the segment, Jay. Are we in the media actually causing the problem by talking about it?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, the Tide Pod thing started out as a joke. You know, kids didn't actually think eating Tide Pods was cool. They were just joking about how, you know, here's this product that's poisonous but looks like candy, and that's really funny to us. And, you know, finally someone decided to go ahead and eat one. And whenever one or two kids do something stupid, it gets reported as a challenge. You know, there have been a lot of sort of fake internet challenges, like the hot water challenge wasn't a real thing, but there were dozens of news stories about it. So, you know, once the news says it's a challenge, then there's another group of kids that thinks that that's a real thing, and it kind of snowballs from there.
Right. And this is a relatively innocuous phenomenon like this. Obviously, it can really hurt people, but there is a slightly lighter side to all of this. This is a phenomenon that we see documented with very, very serious things as well. Things like suicide, when it gets reported by the media, can lead to other people choosing suicide. Mass shooting, identifying mass shooters. Some scientific research has indicated that can inspire other mass shooters to do terrible things. The question, Catherine, for us people like Jay and myself is, how can we responsibly report on these trends and let people know that this dangerous thing is happening without becoming part of the spiral of the problem?
Well, I mean, so for me, I think, yes, there is some research that exposure or, like, you know, hearing about mass shootings can prompt a mass shooting. I think you don't see that happening in someone who doesn't already have some degree of inclination towards, you know, being a mass shooter or being someone who does impulsive things. So for me, I think context is important. We always have to consider not just that one single event, like, you know, media is going to cause something. There's a lot of contextual factors that go into any behavior that occurs. And so I think in general, the media does a relatively well job, I'm sure some sources better than others, of reporting both the positives and the negatives and being upfront about what is occurring and why it's occurring and not over-sensationalizing things. And so for me, I think as long as that continues, it's not so much what can the media do above and beyond that. It's what can parents and adults and others around do to, you know, further the education. So it's specifically about the Tide Pod Challenge, you know, talking to their youth and trying to encourage not just don't eat Tide Pods, but just in general, like the trying to steer them away towards these impulsive behaviors.
Indeed. And as a closing thought here, what advice would you give to parents, Catherine? I think some of them are probably worried that if they tell their children not to eat a Tide Pod, that might have the opposite effect.
Oh, that's a really good point. You know, I've actually interacted with a lot of teenagers in the last 2 weeks since I found out I was going to be on the show trying. And so I've asked them, like, why would you guys do this? And they just kind of look at me like I'm stupid for even having to ask why they would do that. So I don't really know that I have the answer. But I think it's more about, I've been asking myself this question, what could I do for my own kids? And I think one thing that I can do that I would encourage parents to do is to try and encourage adolescents to see the fragile nature of life and that things that can be dangerous really do have the long-term consequences. I know adolescents aren't wired to see things that way. They lack the life experiences. That's a good thing. They haven't been exposed often to a lot of the negative events that make us, you know, fragile and timid about the dangers that exist in this world. But I think as long as we can help hopefully guide them towards a true sense of that and encourage them to make good choices. Always telling them, I tell my five-year-old, just make good choices, you know, be kind, be loving, and think about, you know, being helpful both to your own self and to others around you. So I think as long as we can continue those conversations, we're really on the right track.
It's Catherine O'Neill, Assistant Research Scientist at UGA's College of Family and Consumer Sciences. We were also joined by Jay Hathaway, Senior Writer at The Daily Dot. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Adam.
Up next, going to get in the break room and kick back and break down the past week. But first, host Celeste Headlee is not sold on Black History Month, and it's not for the reasons that you might think. Stick with us.
Is this thing on?
Word.
So what, we get drunk? So what, we don't sleep? We're just having fun. We don't care who sees.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. February is Black History Month. Canada, the United Kingdom, and the Netherlands also have months to commemorate Black achievements. But On Second Thought's very own host, Celeste Headlee, is not sold on Black History Month. She opened up the gripe bag on the subject last year.
I don't like things now compared to the way they used to be.
You know what really grinds my gears?
All this progress. Phooey!
Will you please tell me why?
That's the way it was and we liked it.
Get off my lawn!
Black History Month was the brainchild of eminent historian Carter Woodson. Woodson had a doctorate from Harvard in the 1920s, which is pretty amazing history, if you ask me. In 1926, he wanted to set aside the second week of February as Negro History Week. Why that specific time? Because it included the birthdays of both Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. The purpose was to incorporate the achievements of African Americans into the curriculum in public schools. At that point, only three states joined in: North Carolina, Delaware, and West Virginia. Woodson dedicated his life to the issue of education. He once wrote, "This crusade is much more important than the anti-lynching movement, because there would be no lynching if it did not start in the schoolroom." But Woodson thought Black History Month, or week, was a temporary fix. It was meant to fill in the gaps of history until the achievements and contributions of African Americans were included in the regular curriculum. What would he say if he knew we were still segregating Black history into one month of the year, almost a century after he started this battle? Look, there is no such thing as Black history. Slavery is as much white history as it is Black. How do you talk about Thomas Edison and the invention of the light bulb without mentioning that a Black man invented the filament that goes inside? How do you separate education from Robert Smalls, who helped create the nation's first free and compulsory school system in the U.S.? You know who should be proud of explorer Matthew Henson, the first man to reach the North Pole? All of us, because he wasn't just Black, he was an intrepid American. My grandfather was the dean of Black composers, so orchestras often play his music during February only. That drives me nuts! Do we need a Jewish History Month so we can play Copland and Gershwin? Or a European History Month so we can program Bach and Mozart? Look, I'm not saying we don't need Black History Month. We still have not desegregated our textbooks and lesson plans. But maybe it's time. Quit relegating so-called Black history to the back of the bus. To quote Carter Woodson one more time, the mere imparting of information is not education.
That was On Second Thoughts, Celeste Headlee on Black History Month. She will be back in this hosting chair on Monday. Well, it's been a long week. We've talked about climate change, the civil rights trail, and how religion could make you healthier. So, as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what happened this week. It's time for the break room.
Democrats calling for legislation to protect special counsel Robert Mueller after those reports that President Trump tried to fire him last June.
Georgia went from first to worst, without a doubt. We used to have a very, very generous, perhaps too generous, credit if you bought an electric car.
A dozen donuts for our albino visitors.
Wow, for real?
No man should be so poor he cannot pay for a donut.
Joining us in the break room are Mike Lowry, a children's book author in Atlanta, Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington, Fayette County Commissioner Steve Brown, and with me here in GPB's Macon Outpost is Jessica Walden, communication strategist and co-founder of Rock Candy Tours in Macon. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hello, Adam.
Happy
Hello.
Happy Friday and happy Black History Month.
Indeed. Happy for some. Not Celeste.
Celeste is not here, so let's talk about
that. Exactly. That's right. President Trump has now delivered his first State of the Union address at 1 hour and 20 minutes. It was the third longest by a U.S. president, behind Bill Clinton's speeches in 2000 and 1995. President Trump focused on jobs, the economy, infrastructure, and of course, immigration.
The sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream, because Americans are dreamers too.
Trump tweeted that his State of the Union was the most watched ever. That is indisputably empirically false, but he did get healthy ratings. Let's take a poll. Who on the panel watched the speech?
Well, I didn't watch it, but I did listen to the entire thing.
Well, good for you. We like listening on the radio. Up in Atlanta, anybody watch it?
We did not.
No, and you know, I haven't watched the State of the Union address and all the way back to Ronald Reagan, so it's been a long time. I really care very little about State of the Union addresses. What do they accomplish? I don't know.
And it's so scripted, right? It's someone reading a speech. There's planned applause. And I just, it doesn't communicate anything to me that I thought was worth sitting through.
Well, and you know that it doesn't really carry a lot of weight when some of the big stories are the fact of previous ones that Nancy Pelosi never blinked, Justice Ginsburg slept during the entire thing. I mean, these are the headline events that show up in the newspaper, so you can tell it's really not that.
But weight. By newspaper, you mean BuzzFeed, so that does kind of.
Jessica is the only one who did her homework.
I know, I did my homework. Well, and that's why I listened to it, because I don't like to get distracted by all the pomp and circumstances and see what everybody's doing in the audience. And honestly, I wasn't crazy ever watching the televised with three white males telling me how they were going to make America great again up front. But, you know, it was different for him. I do agree with media on that. It was a little bit more subdued. I appreciate that. Did it inspire me? No. Did he add to my worries? Yes. Did he say anything I wanted to hear? Yes. He mentioned the family leave, which was good. But listening to it, there were a couple moments that bothered me, and this isn't even on him. When he mentioned that the African-American employment rate stands at the lowest rate ever, someone whooped really loud in the audience. Hmm. I don't know if anybody heard that, but it was like a total redneck whoop, and that really bothered me. So that's the kind of stuff you get when you just listen to audio.
Speaking of sound, all of my audio nerd friends on Twitter couldn't help but remarking about how the president kept applauding for himself.
Clapping for himself.
And doing so directly into his microphone.
It was so annoying when you're listening to it. Absolutely.
Hey, why wait for other people to applaud for you?
I'm doing it here in the studio. You guys can't see it. Yeah.
And the thing is, I mean, forgive me for getting into a moment of audio geekery, but with using what is called dynamic range compression, which is this thing that everyone in professional audio uses to basically make the loud softer and the softs louder, by clapping into his microphone, the president had the effect of essentially muting the actual applause from the audience. And there was something poetic to me about that.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you clarified that he was clapping, because I actually thought he was beating his chest. In between.
Yeah, that was good.
Well, you know, Adam, one thing that did come out of that, too, because I knew we were going to discuss this, so I actually watched the highlights at the news agency show, and I was amazed at how old the United States Senate is. I think the average age is probably like 89.5. It's just amazing how many of these people have been there for so long. And if anything needs changing, I think that's probably one of them. That's bipartisan. Let's start looking at some new faces.
Well, it's also the case that, you know, presidential candidates have been getting older, and yes. I do wonder if this is a part of a broader phenomenon about our society, that thanks to advances in medicine, et cetera, that all of us are having more productive and longer working careers until later life. Is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well, I think there's a time to let go. I think there's a creativity and a new perspective that comes with youth that can help us make sense of things that in a way that's not so tethered to tradition and the way we've always done things. So I think we need to make room for some fresh faces, new voices, new thoughts and ideas. I think that's a good thing.
And we should say that the actual average age of the United States Senate is 62 years old.
Oh, I knew you'd fact-check me.
Sorry.
I'm trying to make this show great again.
Facts. Public radio and facts. What's the point? All right, let's move on to another topic. The president did not mention the Russia investigation. This week, the White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said that President Trump will not be addressing the ongoing investigation into Russian efforts to aid his campaign because, according to her, no Americans care about the issue. Let's listen.
We spend more time on that than we do any other topic, despite the fact that time and time again, poll after poll says that, frankly, no one cares about this issue, and it's certainly not the thing that keeps people up at night.
Now, Sarah Sanders is engaging in a bit of hyperbole there. It's not that the polling shows that nobody cares about the issue, but she's absolutely right that this is in no way Americans' top priority, at least based on what the polling tells us. Are we in the media paying too much attention to it? Anybody?
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you. There could be some merit to what's going on. There might not be. But until you get the report from Mueller out here, all you're doing is talking about something that we have no idea how it's going to turn out. You can only do that for so long. And then I think also, too, the complication with the Fusion GPS debacle and seeing how they were involved in the creation of that dossier and things of that nature, that's kind of taken some of the steam out of it. But, I mean, you know, we're it's almost like the boy who's cried wolf. We keep talking about it. Just get the blasted report out, yeah. please, mm-hmm. and let us see the results. And then the American public will make a decision.
And I think there's a difference between not caring and being sick of hearing about the blow by blow. I don't like mm-hmm. watching the way the sausage is made. Right? I just want the sausage on my plate.
I like that.
Yeah, but I do reckon that one of the reasons why people inside the Mueller investigation have been strategically leaking things about it this whole time is to prepare for the event that, in fact, the sausage is never presented mm-hmm. to the plate.
Right.
If the whole thing gets shut down, and also to keep political pressure on everyone involved to keep the sausage making going. Jessica, is that reason enough to keep reporting on it?
Well, I mean, you know, you keep firing people, it's going to be in the news. And so it's going to stay hot. And, you know, I go back to for over 5 years, President Trump wore out conspiracy theories about the Obama birth certificate.
Yeah.
So, you know, 5 years of that. It's not, Russia's not going to go away anytime soon.
And I think it's important for us to recognize that the integrity of our democracy and our voting processes is really, really important, right? And so we need to know one way or the other. Whether the Russians have interfered with our elections, and we need to, particularly in advance of our 2018 elections in the fall, to make sure that our voting processes are secured and are going to operate without interference.
And I honestly don't think anybody, I wouldn't say that anybody's just tired completely of hearing about it altogether. I mean, like you said, that we want to know how the outcome would be. But I also think that just in general, we're just exhausted about everything now, right? Pull us about any topic. I mean, I can't think of anything that I'm passionate about anymore, you guys.
Can we just get to the donuts?
You want to skip to the donut topic? We can skip to the donut topic. So,
on to the donuts.
I mean, honestly, we got time, so let's go ahead and do it. Probably none of us have one of Homer Simpson's signature problems.
Marge, dear, would you kindly pass me a donut?
Donut? What's a donut?
And if you like donuts, you'll probably give the Dapper Donut chain a try. The gourmet donut shop will open at Atlanta's Lenox Mall. I'm looking at their website. The menu of toppings looks to me like they're trying to chart a middle course between the highly gourmetified hipster donut and the more traditional working fellow's donut. You've got your cinnamon sugar, your powdered sugar, but also a s'mores turtle, Nutella dream, fluffer nutter, and donut truffles. Is this what the donut means to you, Jessica?
Well, y'all are up in Atlanta. You get all the fancy donut places. Here, we just turn on the red light and we go get our hot Krispy Kreme. And that is good enough and sweet enough for me.
Yeah.
My teeth hurt just with you talking
Ooh,
about that.
Nothing like a hot Krispy Kreme donut. Except
Atlanta
now,
folks, do you indulge in the hipster donut?
I like donuts. What I don't like is that most donut chains now include the calorie count for donuts.
Yeah.
Like, no one wants to see that. That really ruins the experience.
It's a real bummer. I mean, you know, it really is. But I will agree. There's nothing that beats that vaulted Krispy Kreme on high. I mean, I was born and raised eating those things. They are the most lightest, fluffiest, sweetest things. But unfortunately, as I've told my friends here in the room, that I'm on the keto diet now, and I will not be going to see these gourmet donuts because they're not on the menu. So, and I've lost a lot of weight since I've stopped eating those donuts. So maybe that's something we should all look at.
Too. Well,
I think, you know, I think it's just, if donuts or any dessert or whatever is hot, right? But then I think that the flip side is that then if a Krispy Kreme donut is not hot, It's
so gross.
Yeah, it really is.
So gross.
No, but I do like, so there are two places in town that I do like. I've never heard of Dapper Donuts. I assume that if it's coming to Lenox, that it's some big name thing that I've never heard of before. But I do like Revolution. has a savory donut sandwich thing that's pretty good. And then Sublime Donuts, they do that dulce de leche donut. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, I know you're on a diet, so let me tell you some more donuts that you should try.
I'm starting to tremble right now. Yeah.
They have a bran and oats. No, they don't have them. I couldn't even think of something that sounded healthy.
The spinach donut. I love
that one. It is the best quinoa donut.
All right, before we get to our break, I need to get each of you on the record so that you can be held accountable to the public that you serve. Mike Lowry, yeast or cake?
Oh, yeast.
Tanya Washington.
Cake.
Oh, she thought about it.
Steve Brown.
Cake.
Jessica Walden.
Cake.
Cake.
What? Where am I right now? You guys,
Mike feels like he's in an alter universe. Now.
I do feel like, can we just spend the rest of the time talking about this? Because you guys were talking about Krispy Kreme, that's yeast.
I know.
And then you guys were like, oh, last minute, cake.
I get it. But I'm thinking of other things too. I mean, I'm thinking about everything that you see in front of the at the Starbucks glass counter when you walk up there.
I'm thinking
too,
about all the cake.
I was only thinking of powdered
yeast.
I'm
just looking at my coffee and wanting to dunk a donut in it right now. So cake just came out.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. It's Friday. We are in the break room talking about all the most important news of the week, clearly. just ahead, new survey looking at the safest neighborhoods in the metro Atlanta area. What, in fact, makes a neighborhood safe? What does that even mean? Also, should Georgians be able to buy booze earlier than they now can on Sundays? It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa, in for Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. We're having coffee and conversation in the break room, as we do each Friday, talking about the week's news. My guests are Mike Lowry, children's book author in Atlanta, also Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington, Fayette County Commissioner Steve Brown, and with me here at GPB Macon is Jessica Walden, co-founder of Rock Candy Tours. Let's talk about cars.
Welcome to the electric car of the future.
I'm an electric car. I can't go very fast or very far.
Dated reference, electric cars have gotten quite fast and far-reaching. Some Georgia lawmakers say that they want to revive the original electric car credit. You used to get a $5,000 state tax credit in Georgia for buying a zero-emissions vehicle, and doing away with that tax credit apparently took a big dent, or put a big dent, in the sales of electric vehicles in Georgia. The question before us is, would bringing the tax credit back make any of us consider buying an electric car? Mike?
I don't think that it would be a hard sell for me to want to buy an electric car in the first place. So I think that it's kind of like already doing something in favor of something that I would want to do anyway. I would be interested to know why that credit went away. I am thinking of it only one-sided, which is thinking, the government doesn't want to support this thing that's better for the environment. But I don't know, maybe it's not the case. I don't know. I didn't see that part.
Well, I think...
Tanya? Go ahead.
It started, I think, the reason it was taken away was related to gas taxes, because mm-hmm. you were paying for transportation projects through your gas tax. Obviously, they're not paying a gas tax. But now, speaking absolutely hypocritically, I have actually taken that tax credit, but I don't think you necessarily need to bring it back. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because these electric vehicles, although they're electric, they're not necessarily green. And I think we're getting close to that, but a lot of it's carbon-based produced electricity. These half a ton battery packs that are in these things are very hard to recycle, and what do you do with all the waste that comes with them? And so there's a long way to go. Tesla and some of these other places are working on recycling these large batteries, and we're working on producing clean electricity. Mm-hmm. And when you get further down the road, perhaps, bring it back.
Mm-hmm. And I find them to be quite expensive. I'm not really a car person. I'm more interested in having a driver of my Honda CR-V 2002. But given that there are so many critiques, and I think legitimate critiques in terms of their environmental impact, I think people think of them as being much more environmentally friendly when they're not necessarily that. And so that plus the added cost, to me, doesn't offset this credit.
Yeah, you mentioned the cost. The old tax credit was $5,000. It was regarded by a lot of policy geeks who think about this stuff to be shockingly generous. California does $2,500 as a tax incentive to buy electric vehicles. And in fact, that is what legislators are proposing now for the new tax credit in Georgia. But when we consider that, you know, what does a Tesla start at? $35,000 or $40,000, something like that?
Yeah.
Jessica, would $2,500 tax credit make a difference if you're already spending that much on a car? If you're the kind of person who has that kind of money?
If you're that, I mean, you know, you'd probably use a tax credit like that. I mean, you know, but what I find so interesting about this is, you know, when Georgia killed it, they kind of made up for it by adding a $200 registration fee, which was higher than gasoline cars. I think gasoline cars was around $165. Mm-hmm. And so Georgia really became this case study on like what happens when your incentives go away and you're ultimately penalized for what those incentives were. I drive a hybrid. I would love to upgrade to electric. I just hate pumping gas. Like, that's really what it comes down to me. I'm a solopreneur. I could use that kind of tax credit.
Well,
but
you got
I'm
that
with
gas,
you. Those cars are expensive.
You've got that gas on your hand, and then when you go to eat the donut and you don't have anywhere to wash your hands, I mean, it's a problem.
I only want to go to gas stations for coffee and donuts, not to fill up my car.
The struggle.
Let's go back to the donuts. So you guys said cake?
It's okay. We can't do donuts again, but we could talk about brunch. There are a few things in my experience more disappointing in life than showing up for brunch somewhere in Georgia, ordering a mimosa, and being told, no, sir, we cannot sell that to you until 12:30 in the afternoon, because that's what the law is here in the state. There is now a push in the Georgia legislature to allow alcohol sales starting at 11 a.m. on Sunday. Again, right now it's 12:30. Good move. What do we think, Tanya?
Well, when I first moved here and I tried to buy alcohol on Sunday, the lady was like, sorry, can't sell it to you. And I said, oh, no, I just look really young. I'm old enough. And she's like, no, you're old enough. We just don't sell it to anyone. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what is the justification for 11 a.m. versus 12:30 versus 10:30 versus 9 o'clock. Like, I like for legislation to be rational in terms of justifications, and I just don't see that. I'm in favor of it, however, because brunch does begin at 11 or maybe 10:30.
Sure. Yeah.
And I'd like to be able to get my mimosa.
Yeah. Now, Tanya's using the word rational and legislation in the same sentence.
Oh, don't do that. Yeah.
I'm worried.
It seems like I think that the law is only in place because they know that I need to get stuff done on Sunday afternoons. And they think he needs to wait until at least 12:30 before he has a Bloody Mary, or he's just going to, you know, take a nap. His day will be washed.
I believe the historical origin of said legislation is the idea that you don't want people showing up drunk for church, right, Jessica?
I love that. I love that they've now, so it was at 12:30 when church is out is when you can order your booze. Now it is 11 when church starts. You can now, so they make sure everybody's in church, close the doors, and then you can go buy your booze.
So in defense of those proposing to simply move the time from 12:30 to 11, they are politicians, and yes, they like to be rational whenever possible, but they have to work in the real world, and there are still very vibrant political forces in Georgia who care very much about church on Sunday, and they're trying to strike a reasonable compromise, a middle ground. Is this not a perfectly reasonable middle ground?
Well, I mean, there are 8 o'clock services at most churches, right? So if you go to church at 8, you're out by 10, so why not 10:15, right? I'm just trying to figure out what information they're using as the basis for selecting 11 a.m.
Well, and why would they be connected at all? I mean, who cares when anything gets out, you know, whatever. It doesn't make sense there would be a connection.
I'm quite libertarian on the issue. I mean, it's just allow people to do what they do. If you are legally allowed to consume alcohol, I really don't have any problems with what time and what day you buy it.
And how do you know that you're not coming in church drunk from the night before?
Exactly.
It happens.
And those people
I've
are to be commended.
I've been to some of Jessica's parties. I know of what she speaks.
That could be a whole other segment. Let's think about that for next week.
Guys, I have an idea
Indeed.
For Sunday.
It's not fair on that whole hair the dog thing.
If you're just joining us, we are hanging out in the break room talking about all the week's news, significant and perhaps less so, with children's book author Mike Lowry, Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington, Fayette County Commissioner Steve Brown, and Jessica Walden, communication strategist and co-founder of Macon's Rock Candy Tours. So another consumer issue, another pocketbook issue. Georgia Power customers finally expect to see a small change for the better in their utility bills. The company is paying, they say, $139 million less than anticipated toward the expansion of Plant Vogtle. This is a controversial nuclear power plant. The company cites two reasons for why they're paying less for this money and therefore, paying less money for this plant and why they are therefore passing less of that cost onto us, the users. These two reasons being the federal corporate tax cut and also a more than $1.7 billion payment from Toshiba. Now, what does this all mean for Georgia Power customers? Beginning in April, someone who uses 1,000 kilowatt hours a month, that's pretty common, will pay around $2.70 less a month. Yahtzee.
Exactly.
Unless you go to one of these fancy Today's hipster places, right. It's going to get you like a donut hole. Perhaps better news, there'll also be a $75 lump sum rebate to each customer. The state utility regulators ordered Georgia Power to give that to us. So, first question. Does this matter to anyone? Will this make a difference to anyone?
You know, I when I first read that, I thought, wow, make it rain. This is just incredible. Now, you've got billions and billions of dollars of overcost. They're going to give me $75. Man, this is great. It's all equitable. Everything's fine with the world. And, you know, this nuclear plant is a disaster, and it's going to continue to be a disaster.
You think that for people who are not read into the whole Plant Vogtle thing.
Well, there has never been a nuclear plant, for starters, that has actually been built to cost anyway, to cost estimates. But now with the regulations and all the hoops they have to jump through, and so most of that is for very good reasons, for safety reasons and national security reasons now because of terrorism, you have to really look at things and you have to expend your costs. So the problem you've got with it is that it's just not cost feasible. It's cost prohibitive. So you got to get out of these things. And a 70-year lifespan is what they probably are looking at with this plant. They will never make that money back. So if you're looking at it from an investment standpoint, you've blown it.
Tanya?
So we're getting $75 back. My question is, how much am I actually owed? Because I'm sure it's more than $75, but we don't have a sense of like what that overage is. So I'm always skeptical when I get these refund checks from my creditors that I wasn't anticipating. I'm like, you owe me more than that. Mm-hmm. This is just the payoff money.
Jessica, what are you going to do with your $75?
I'm like, where are they going to make up for that $75? It's kind of like that electric car credit. They made up for it.
Yeah, Georgia Power giveth with one hand and taketh away with another.
But, you know, I just moved from a giant historic home into a tiny little country house. And our only utility bill is electricity. So I'm saving this year no matter what. But I'll take their $75.
Well done. let's see. More serious topic. Question is, how safe do you feel your neighborhood is?
This is the riot. This is the riot. This is the riot.
What are you yelling about?
Like you said, you broke the law by making an illegal U-turn, and I hereby, as a citizen of the town of Mayberry in the United States of America, arrest you.
Hooray!
Oh, Mayberry. A new National Council for Home Safety and Security report ranks the safest cities in Georgia. 8 of the top 10 are metro Atlanta suburbs. They include communities like Peachtree City, Roswell, and Kennesaw. Safest communities in Georgia. Some of the least safe ones were also metro Atlanta, Waycross, College Park, East Point. I wonder, whenever we talk about safe places to live, if that's even the right question. What I always ask myself is, safe for whom? You know what I mean, Tanya? Yeah.
I do. And, you know, I think there's all sorts of class and race and socioeconomic overtones to how we define what a safe place is. And you can have different interpretations of how safe a neighborhood is, even among neighbors who live within proximity of one another.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we have some neighbors that, so I've lived in Atlanta for 9 to almost maybe 10 years now, and I have been broken into 3 times in 2 different neighborhoods and attempted one more that I showed up and they were there. And so I think because of that, I think that we live in an awesome town and I do feel really, really safe. And so that anecdotally, I don't think that that speaks to the safety of our, you know, our whole town. But I have another neighbor who doesn't look at the same, you know, neighborhood mm-hmm. pages, who doesn't realize that stuff like that is constantly happening in our neighborhood. And I'll say too, so I live in Decatur, which was, if I remember right, maybe 14 on the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I agree that the idea of what would be considered safe or not, and also Decatur is so big mm-hmm. that, you know, I was sort of looking at I've lived there for a while, and I realized that it kind of goes from like North DeKalb Mall down to like the Miami airport mm-hmm. in, you know, Southern Florida. So it's pretty big, right?
Yeah.
But it feels like that when you're looking at houses or looking yeah. for a place to live.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
You realize that Decatur's really big and it's so diverse mm-hmm. in the different areas that which is what drew me to living in that part of the town to begin with. You know, I liked, you know, the different mm-hmm. options of town. So anyway, yeah. it just seems kind of strange that you could then sum up this area when I would assume that these unsafe places, it might be street to street, depending, mm-hmm. you know, Baltimore
yeah,
was like
sure.
that.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Jessica, we deal with that in Macon all the yeah. time. There's sort of a popular perception that we live in a dangerous town, but I always ask people, which Macon are you talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there is the idea of perception of crime just as much as perception of safety. And mm-hmm. we've worked on neighborhood revitalization projects. One of the reasons I started my tour company was simply getting people to get out and walk on the street and see things from that neighborhood street level point of view. And so, you know, the key word here is neighborhood. When you get to know your neighbors, when you live in a community, when you look out for each other, those are the things that make your place safe. And, you know, the perception versus reality, you really can't line up statistics to create those things.
And Steve, as a local elected official, I imagine you want to weigh in.
As a former mayor of Peachtree City, I'm taking full credit for the safety of Peachtree City and the high ranking. Okay, I'm just saying that for the record.
He's on a golf cart right now.
But honestly, seriously though, affluence equals safety in these statistics. You go mm-hmm. to the area where you have the highest median incomes, the highest level of affluence. They are all the time the safest areas, and I think there's a sociological aspect to this that. Elected officials, police agencies, all these things, they take it very seriously because they know the affluent people are going to fund campaigns. They know that they're going to complain and they're going to use their will if things go wrong. And that's why you see probably a lot more police presence in affluent areas than some of these other areas.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we've got a minute left. I like to, when we have time, say briefly what we're doing this weekend. Jessica, what are your plans?
Oh my gosh, I actually have a free weekend, but we have some music history tours happening in Macon. We got people for that and enjoying our unseasonably semi-winter fallish weather and enjoying country life. That's my new thing right now.
That's Jessica Walton, co-founder of Rock Candy Tours in Macon. Steve Brown, Fayette County Commissioners, what you getting up to this weekend?
Well, you know, I am just drowning in government work, and I'm having to catch up. And you can read about some of that in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution today in the Watchdog section. But there are a lot of issues, serious issues, that I'm working on, and I'll be continuing that this weekend.
Oh, well done. Tanya Washington of Georgia State University.
I am headed to Birmingham, Alabama to give a keynote address on, wait for it, Celeste, Black History Month.
Oh, dear, I hope she's not listening.
Love you, Celeste.
And children's book author Mike Lowry, what you getting up to this weekend?
Well, I realized that it's my wife's birthday coming up, so this weekend I'm going to just scramble to find something to get her. No, that's not true. I have something for her.
Donuts.
There's donuts.
I'm going to go get some donuts.
Donuts and a mimosa before 12:30 on Sunday.
Perfect.
Right. Not mimosa.
Well, thank you all for joining us on The Break Room. That is it for our show today here on Second Thought, but we always want to hear your thoughts. We were talking about safe neighborhoods. What does that mean to you? What is a safe neighborhood? Do you feel that your neighborhood is safe? Why or why not? You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can reach us on our Facebook page on Second Thought. For today, that is on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Celeste Headley is back at you on Monday. Have a good weekend.